Hi everyone, Bread and Goods is sponsored by Works in Progress, the online magazine. I really enjoy reading Works in Progress, and my favorite piece of theirs has been The Housing Theory of Everything. In the piece, the authors provide astounding evidence for why a huge swath of our social ills are caused by our inability to build more housing. It's a pretty mind-blowing piece if you've never read it. You can find their works online on worksinprogress.co. The link is in the show notes.
Welcome to the Bread and Goods podcast. I have a very special guest, Harry Law, who does governance and policy at DeepMind and is also a PhD student in the at the University of Cambridge. Hi, Harry. Nice to have you on.
Hi, and great to be here. Hopefully, looking forward to a good conversation. Should be fun.
So before we start this, I'd like to say that Harry's opinions are his own and his only. Nothing in this should be taken as a representative of Google or DeepMind or any related entity's policy position. So now let's start. So would you like to add anything to that?
No, that sounds good. As you said, these opinions are mine only. Hopefully that's enough for you guys listening. And they may not be representative of the organizations that I'm affiliated with.
All right. So I'm going to start. My first question is about something that's being debated on Twitter quite hotly. It's about whether we should open source frontier AI models. And I know you're not entirely in favor of that. So the case that people would put in favor of that would be that open source generally leads to people being able to do interpretability work. They're able to use it, find all the flaws in it. They are able to write evals and so on. And even if considering from a purely safety perspective, we should not be so. We should allow open sourcing of these frontier AI models. And the other evidence they would say was that GPT-3, we had quite a few open source versions. The net harm from those is, I don't think anybody's come up with a number, but I can't think of a scenario where the net harm is higher than net benefit. So what's your take on that?
I think fundamentally I would try to sort of reframe the question in the sense that people get stuck in this binary of to open source or to not open source, right? And for the most part, really what we're talking about is degrees of access, right? And access is a spectrum. So it's a spectrum with respect to the different types of methods and mechanisms that you might be able to employ to be able to sort of get at these different models in lots of different contexts. But it's also a sort of spectrum when you think about it, linearly over time, right? So at the moment, the settlement around what degree of access should be appropriate for different systems, in my mind, is going to be very different to the settlement that might emerge in the future. So I wrote about this a little bit in the context of the EU's AI Act, and actually me and some colleagues from Google DeepMind advocated for fewer restrictions on open source models, and at least in the sort of immediate term in the context of the AI Act. Instead, one of the things that we suggested was that demonstrably more powerful models than those that sort of exist today that are released on an open source basis should be subject to some sort of evaluations beforehand. And the idea there that it was a bit of a compromise in that it wouldn't mean that there would be a sort of liability regime attached to different open source models right here, right now, but would hopefully give you a degree of safety, a kind of backstop, I suppose, in the future. And I think, sort of applying that at the kind of macroscopic scale, for me, the question is like, okay, if we're saying that models are going to increase in capability, which I'm sure we agree that they are, then that necessarily means that the risk profile associated with them is also going to increase, right? As well as their ability to sort of benefit the world as well. It's only right to develop new or specific, I suppose, frameworks for access when you think about a given model in a given context that's appropriate or at least kind of commensurate with its capability profile. And that's really the starting point, I suppose. And we sort of talk about different contexts in which I think open source approaches are, say open source in inverted commas, liberal access approaches are beneficial, and those that are not. But in general, I'm of the belief that it is possible to find a middle ground that gets at some of those things that you talked about there in terms of transparency, robustness, lots of eyes on these things on the one hand, but also actually makes sure that you're not releasing systems that can be totally reconstituted in a potentially harmful way. And what I mean by that is there was actually research out from a couple of weeks ago that demonstrated pretty clearly that you can remove any fine-tuning that you do for a model once it has been released on an open source maximalist basis. And for me, I don't really understand why you'd need a totally open source version of a model when it comes with that sort of profile of risk, when there are plenty of other mechanisms for sort of solving for those other pieces as well.
In this debate, I feel that the most common counterpoint to your case would be that what in like let's imagine we did have a complete like a base model open sourced out. What do you think the order of magnitude of the costs would be? I've tweeted out a few times, but I've never got an answer. Let's see, in normal policy analysis, we do sort of ballpark these numbers, right? What would be the order of magnitude of the harms? How do you get to that? How do you get to that estimate?
Yeah, I mean, it really depends over what timescale we're talking about, right? So if we're discussing open sourcing the most capable models as they exist today, I agree that the harms are unlikely to be, incredibly severe. With the caveat that, of course, this is a really difficult thing to quantify as well as, frankly, qualify as well. It's almost like describing the difference between a internet-enabled world and a world without the internet. You think about the different harms that are, posed or exacerbated by something as broad and vast and wide as the internet, and trying to apply, that in the sort of same context as AI. That's a phenomenally difficult thing to do, right? And it seems like a bit of a cop out to say, well, the harms are too vast, or at least like the potential surface area of like potential harms is too vast. But really, I think that that's kind of gets at the core of the question, because for the most part, people, as you sort of said, struggle to point to specific instances in which things have been open sourced and have caused harms that are very, very clear, right? Where you draw that sort of A to B connection. But for the most part, at least as far as I understand it, I would say that the risks are about, lowering barriers to entry right across the board. And that's about lowering barriers to entry for malicious activity, fundamentally. So if you're a bad actor and you want to, for example, develop sophisticated malware, you could probably do that, right? By seeing what's available on the internet today. It would take a bit of time to piece that all together, but you could probably do that. The issue is that, like, if we're talking about releasing a model which is capable of helping someone do that, then that degree of assistance is going to lower barriers to entry in such a manner that you might get a few instances of people being able to create these things who otherwise wouldn't have been able to. And now that's more of a kind of conceptual argument, and the tricky thing is there is you can't really, place or at least sort of understand where that threshold actually lies. It's all about making the case, or at least understanding that capabilities are going to be proportionate to both benefits and harms. And because we're talking about something which is so vast, there are going to be edge cases that might not have happened in a world in which these models aren't open sourced, that do occur in a world where they are. And that is really just a function of scale, right? And I would say that I am in two minds about
Sorry,
as to,
by scale, do you mean size of the model or like size of user?
No, exactly. I mean scale of usage rather than the size of the model. Although, of course, more powerful models is essentially the same as bigger models, and bigger models mean greater potential for harm, which will be sort of applied at that scale in terms of numbers of users. So all those things are connected, right?
The issue is that when we propose these, so normally, right, and I don't think this is always a good thing, but normally when new technologies come, We want to see where they go right, where they go wrong. And so as long as they aren't, existentially risky, we say, okay, we can tolerate a plane crash. I mean, we are willing to tolerate a plane crash in expectation before we regulate it, right? And for these things, it seems, sort of seems that these approaches, before the planes take off, we're saying we should have these safety apply. We should have these safety rules, and they should be like this. And the answer is, the optimal number of ex ante plane crashes is not zero, right? So why should we legislate before we even have credible empirical estimates? We just, maybe the harms are greater than the benefits, but like my intuition says, the benefits are greater than the harms, and yours might say something else, and so on. I feel like we shouldn't be. I mean, we should be epistemically humble enough to say, hey, maybe it's greater, maybe it's lesser. Let's give it a few years and see what happens.
Right. So that's an interesting provocation. So I would say fundamentally, the plane crash metaphor is an interesting one. I'll come to that in a second. But first thing I would say is that, like, look, I agree with a lot of that in that there is no other example of technology out there where we don't tolerate a degree of risk, and that should be the same for AI. So I totally agree that, when we think about risk, it needs to be in a kind of multifaceted but also kind of mature way. It shouldn't be about trying to reduce the risk profile of these things to zero, because that would essentially nerf them in a way which makes them useless. What it should be about is reducing the risk profile in a proportionate way relative to capabilities. The other thing I would say, just thinking about conceptions of responsibility, is that I'm sort of the belief that it's not just developers, regulators, companies that have responsibility to build and use these things in a safe way, but it's also people, right? It's people as well. So there should be a degree of personal responsibility associated with use, and especially misuse as well. So I think that sort of conception of responsibility, at least as I see it, is slightly different to, some more traditional, shall we say, interpretations of the phrase responsible AI, the capital R. But to go back to the plane crash metaphor, so I would think about it in terms of crashworthiness, right? So, you mentioned that we don't we haven't legislated for safety in the aviation industry in the context of planes. We don't do that before they take off. But of course, while we don't do that on the basis of each individual plane, we do it at the industry wide level, right? You have standards bodies that are certified by an international regulator, and then they deem different airlines to be flight worthy. So I think that is actually an interesting model. And by the way, as like a quick sidebar, that civilian certification model is something that people have been looking at, and I think it's potentially quite promising. But perhaps we'll come on to that when we talk about international regulation. But really, to get back to this core idea of crashworthiness, it's the idea that you want to make sure that the planes, the cars, whatever it is that we're talking about, whichever metaphor we want to use, aren't built in such a way as to completely minimize risk. But actually, we want to make sure that at the point at which accidents do happen, and accidents will happen because that is the nature of building technology, they're not so severe and they don't cause as much damage as they otherwise would, right? So I'll give you another example. There's this idea of auto safety, crashworthiness in auto safety, and that led to the development of the seatbelt, right? So if you think about it, why is a seatbelt in a car? In an ideal world, you wouldn't use the seatbelt because you'd never crash. But people realize that actually you are going to crash, and there's no getting around that. We tolerate that degree of risk. Therefore, let's put seatbelts in the cars. And hey presto, what do you know? The total number of fatalities associated with auto accidents dropped massively. And that might seem like quite a pessimistic thing to do, or quite fatalistic, but actually, it's had the exact opposite effect, at least as you think about it in terms of the impact on people's lives and mortality rates.
So this seatbelt is an interesting analogy, and maybe we'll go into segment about which analogies are good and bad. But like for most of these things, the like so the way I think of policy in general is, do we identify a harm? What is the is like you know is the cost benefit worth it? Can the cost be internalized and so on, right? So like let me assume for a second that the cost benefit of these restrictions is worth it. We still haven't really shown that. Like the seatbelt example is great because car crashes are clear, like a transfer of problem from the car company or driver A to driver B. But the solution ultimately came internally from Volvo, which made the seatbelts without any government rule saying that you should make seatbelts like this. They did because the costs of car crashes were internalized by the, I mean, you know, costs of unsafe cars were to some extent internalized by the companies doing it. So in that sense, you know, let me say we have some classical misalignment problems with our with open source models or whatever this we consider happening. People would say, hey, and that happens in open source programs all the time. I say, hey, Python, this version, you know, has this security problem. And Python, which wants to maintain its reputation as a good programming language, fixes it. And there's no need for government regulation on that or on the seatbelt thing. We didn't make it mandatory later once the solution existed to put seatbelts. That's a very different thing from pre-deciding that, oh, cars are going to crash. We need some solution. Like, you know, for in the open source world, people have a reputation to maintain. They won't want it to be used like that. And in fact, Llama 2 are over, you know, RLHF because they've definitely hit that part of the trade-off where they say useless stuff because which might be potentially risky. Like if you've seen the screenshot of I think it's how do you kill a Linux process? And then Llama says, oh, you shouldn't kill Linux processes. What if you hurt their feelings? And like that's clearly an example of, you know, them over internalizing the externality of harmful content. What do you have to say about all of this?
Yeah, look, I think it comes down to the question of proportionality, right? In general, I'm not hugely interested in the sort of focus for, you know, quote unquote safety efforts being the linguistic restrictions. Or I mean, I am in the sense that obviously we're talking about textual outputs and therefore some or all useful restrictions therefore need to be kind of linguistic in nature. But what I mean by that is, I suppose, more from a semantic perspective, which is that it isn't all that clear to me that it is beneficial to have a model that follows a very sort of prescriptive set of rules about what it can or can't say in every instance. And the key thing there is in every instance, because, you know, absolutely there are some people who want to use the models and that, you know, sort of adheres to their version of safety. Obviously, though, on the other hand, as you sort of mentioned, there are lots of folks who don't do that. They want to have a more a liberal experience with using these things, and that to me is like a bit of a microcosm of the broader culture war, or at least the battleground that the culture warriors have sort of found at the moment, which is the development and release of these large models. I think the ultimately AI, especially in this context, is a cipher for your own politics. Right, and that's why you get these different views because people have different expectations with respect to free speech, with respect to capabilities and diffusion, with respect to the risk profile that they personally want to associate with a particular model. However, you've got to think about like the impact that someone's own ability to use a model without limitations has on someone else, you know. Like, you know, it sort of comes back to the old Hegelian idea about whether true freedom is actually being free from the state or not. And, you know, there are lots of different ways to cut the cake there. But my own view is that you probably need to do a mixture of things. You have to take into account the sorts of preferences that individuals have. You have to take into account the preferences of groups, and you have to take into account, you know, preferences is perhaps the wrong word in this context, but the impact on society writ large as well. It's quite a difficult thing to unpick, but it is one where you have to try and tick multiple boxes or at least balance multiple points of views with one approach.
Yeah, so I mean I agree with that. I just don't agree that the external like the costs won't be internalized by the makers of these models, and B, the externality will be large enough to warrant intervention.
Right, but it doesn't. The problem here is that we don't know what the it, which specific standards or mechanisms are we talking about versus which particular externalities, right? The question there is that the, you know, the balance between those two things when you're talking about, you know, bad language or whatever is like quite obvious, you know. I think everyone would agree that you don't want to try and nerf the capabilities of the models and make them overly restricted just to prevent them from, a little bit of bad language. That to me obviously feels not proportionate. But the issue is that by creating models that have no restrictions, that will allow them to, talk to you about anything or swear or whatever it is that you want to do, that's fine. But it also allows you to do lots of other bad things as well. For example, there are models out there that are pretty good, not perfect, but pretty good at least giving you a few ideas for how to build a simple homemade explosive. So, it feels to me like it's a slightly more complex question than that. But the problem is, of course, like if you agree that there is a line in the sand that you should draw up somewhere, where exactly do you draw that? Especially in a way which essentially, means that you're not ultimately allowing minor interventions to sort of snowball into major impacts when you have the model and it and the way people which are using it after it's been diffused through the economy.
Okay. That's. I mean, I don't agree there, but I understand that. One more thing I want to talk to you is of course that about timelines, right? So, when we see like so I have this like in Marxism they have this theory of history. Now we have capitalism. Like we had feudalism. Now we have capitalism. Tomorrow we will have socialism, and next month we will have communism, right? And like I've always felt that many times when people talk about AI scaling and AI timelines, they have the same sort of certainty that comes with this mindset. You say, hey, N years we're gonna hit AGI, so we gotta start, and they start working backwards from that. And I feel that's not a like there's this there are two ways of looking at it, right? One is that N years we're going to hit AGI, and so let's focus on developing solutions for that. And the other one is let's cross the river by feeling the stones, to appropriate the Chinese proverb. And I feel that there's no other part of public policy where option A is more appropriate, because in mundane things like technical standards for TCP, we don't know what's going to happen 30 years later. In things as complex as AI, maybe we might hit AGI in 30 years, maybe we won't. But regardless, we can't really make policy decisions based on these predictions, because the world is in the future is too complex. What do you think of my theory of history critique?
Yeah, I think again, it comes down to what, timelines in two senses. Of course, timelines, as you describe them, in terms of what is the horizon that we're talking about, is for when we feel that these highly intelligent generalizable systems are going to be here. But two, it's that actually, I don't know of anyone who is thinking about planning for a world that exists in 30 years' time when they think about AI policy. So for me, I suppose it depends whether or not you're saying that folks are out here trying to create policy frameworks for a period in time that is inappropriate in a sense that it's just too far away, or whether or not we're talking about the development of legislation that doesn't have appropriate sunset clauses, for example, and then sort
No,
of
I mean like
extended
let's
to.
so let's take the open source thing as an example, right? At this moment, even if like let's take like for example GPT-4 was open source, I don't think for that the enormous benefits would outweigh the harm. Would be less than the harms. I mean, you might disagree with me there, but the argument against open sourcing is said that hey, in f not 30, but like hey, in the future we're gonna hit a point where this balance flips, and we have set this precedent now that the future capable models shouldn't do this, shouldn't be open source because they'll be more harmful. And I'm saying you the premise of your argument that they'll be more harmful and they'll even exist in the future, I don't buy that.
You disagree with the idea that models
I
are
don't know.
becoming
I'm no. I disagree with the idea that you can plan that you can or should plan policy with this level of certainty in mind. Because I mean, if you see, it's hard enough to plan 5 years ahead in these things, and you can't just assume that it's going to happen then. And like the second thing is, once it happens, we need to see it in real life to estimate if the open source costs and benefits match, which is the other part, which is like one other side argument to this. But like my general point is, make policy arguments with data we have today, not with extrapolations of what's going to happen tomorrow, largely because this field does not amend itself well to extrapolations.
Yeah, sure. But I guess think about it in practical terms. So to go to the open source question, the stuff that we suggested for the EU AI Act, we were saying that, today the open source models are probably not powerful enough to warrant any severe restrictions. However, they might in the future. That doesn't mean that all open source models in the future are sort of dealt this blanket set of restrictions that means they can't be released. The suggestion was they ought to be able to pass evaluations in order to do that, right? So when you talk about the sort of future facing policy, you're not setting yourself up in a way that prevents you from having any wiggle room in this sort of hypothetical future. If you do it well, what you're trying to do is give yourself flexible guardrails, rules, whatever you want to call them, guidelines that allow people to open source models that are demonstrably safe. And that the key point there is like demonstrably, right? Which is once they pass evaluations, they'd be able to be released. So you're not trying to legislate for some sort of utopian world or anything like that. You're not trying to be too prescriptive. Ideally, what you want to do with regulation is keep it flexible, but also relevant for the current moment. And the other thing you have to bear in mind is that like the field is moving so phenomenally quickly, right? Which means that very quickly the legislation is appropriate for today is no longer appropriate for the future. So by trying to sort of aim a few steps down the path, that kind of gets you into a position where you're able to build laws that are going to be suitable, not really for the future, because by the time they come into effect, they actually will be relevant for sort of right here, right now. It actually reminds me of some of the arguments that went alongside the introduction of the European Union's GDPR. And I think there's a lot to say about that rule, and too much to sort of go into details right here right now. But what I will say is that the way they described it at the time, the folks who came up with the thing was regulating the realities, right? And that's the situation that you don't want to be caught in with AI. You don't want to be 5 years behind the times trying to legislate for something which is already passed by lawmakers, is already widely diffused into the economy. You want regulation to keep pace with progress.
This target of ours is going to be emphasized given the which would you like it to be, for example, 2 years ahead or 2 years behind? As in, do you think the like the costs of over legislating are worse than the costs of under legislating? And this, of course, with the assumption that the required legislation increases over time, which, I mean, that's the background assumption here.
It's totally context dependent, right? I think it really depends on the scale of harm that might be associated with that lag versus the benefits associated with it as well. Or rather, I suppose it's about trading off what happens in those 2 years when there's no legislation, and the extent to which that poses harms, material, physical, financial, whatever it might
No,
be, or what.
I mean, like if we were to target, like for example, I was making a law, and I'd say, it's almost 2024 at this point. So I'd say, do I want to make a law targeting 2022 AI, or do I want to make a law targeting my estimation of 2026 AI? And which of the four? Because those are the two ways of looking at it, right? And of course, the plus minus two can become five. Or I mean, if you're at, depending on the incompetence of your government, the minus two can become minus five or minus seven or whatever. And depending on how ambitious your policy is going to be, the plus two can become plus five or seven or so on. Would you rather have take the like would you rather over legislate, let's say in terms of evaluations, or whichever specific field you're whichever specific concept you're talking about, which side of the trade-off would you take?
I mean, it's going to completely change based on the specific piece of the puzzle that we're referring to.
So
But for
in which
about
fields would you lay chill, and which ones would you
yeah,
be a little more strong?
so I'll give you one which I would be happy to be overly zealous on. Unsurprising, given I mentioned it a couple of times, but evaluations, absolutely. Evaluations is something which has pretty minimal cost for implementation. Like, yes, we can argue that it favors bigger players because they have the capacity to do those sorts of things. And of course, there's a time element associated with them because they take quite a long time to implement if you're doing them correctly. But ultimately, you know, the compliance costs really aren't that great. And it gives you a decent, well, I would say probably my favored tool, I suppose, or method for being able to understand the capabilities, right, on the one hand, but also therefore be able to add that kind of protective layer. But I'd say that that second point, the protective layer, is only secondary. Really, what matters is understanding the nature of capabilities, because then you can move, act, legislate appropriately in response to that.
So in this sense, you might, There's some things you could do, and I feel that the lowest touch solution would be to, you know how consumer safety is done in the EU, where you can release a product into the market, but you put a sticker saying I comply with these things, and then randomly they check if your product actually complies with these electrical, you know, safety rules, and if it doesn't, you're forced to recall it, which works. You know, in some sense with AI, which is that you can release any model you want, we'll evaluate it. I know those yet to be, you know, decided thresholds. If we feel it's harmful, you'll be forced to retract it. How does that sound?
Explain that one to me in a little bit more detail.
So, like, let's say I am OpenAI and I release GPT-5 to the public, and the condition for leasing it is that I have to certify that it's some standard compliant, and then that standard to be defined in the future. And the government says release it, but we'll test all your models, you know, in some time frame. If it doesn't meet these standards, you'll be forced to shut down API access, which is a lot more, which is definitely which avoids the costs of like smaller companies not being able to do it, because the government does the testing on its own servers and so on.
So sorry, you're talking about post deployment evaluations
here. So you certify, you self certify, and the government checks your certification.
I think that is a good model for most harms that we're talking about. Right, I think that works well for in lots of different contexts. One area that I'm not sure would work well for is the dangerous capability evaluations. Right, I think labs have to do those before models are released, because otherwise you're in a situation in which the horse might have already bolted.
How dangerous is dangerous? What's your disaster scenario like?
Dangerous capability is quite well defined. You'd be thinking about things like ability to replicate autonomously, ability to act autonomously. You could also look for specific things around cybersecurity, bioweapons, that sort of thing. Like, really, I'm talking about like potential for catastrophic risk. So a limited number of things.
And I'm skeptical that, for example, in our current paradigm of large language models and, you know, large multimodal models as it's happening now, that these things will ever become self-replicating. And of course, cybersecurity and bioweapons is a separate thing. But I mean, I don't find that likely at all, because in the end, they're next token predictors or next pixel. And they're trying to, you know, or some extent, some are diffusion models. If you had both text and image output, and like these things, if you look at the architecture, it seems almost inconceivable that they'll autonomously replicate. Or like even for bioweapons, I'm not so. The way I see it is that the binding constraint for bioweapons has always been physical testing, as in, and like even if you gave somebody a million ideas, they'd still have to physically get a lab and build it and get somebody to build a DNA samples and so on. So it's not clear to me why this should be the, like, if you were to focus on bioweapons, these systems would be the target to, you know,
yeah,
you should target.
There's a few things on that then. So starting with bioweapons, I actually think that the bio risk isn't all the profile of bio risk isn't all that clear at the moment. I mean, I wrote about this last week, and I do think it is a case of kind of Schrodinger's bio risk, in the sense that, you know, on paper, it seems to make quite a lot of sense that if you reduce barriers to entry, more people will be able to build bioweapons. And that is not a good thing, rather, because it potentially opens up a larger option space for risk. However, that's what the internet does, right? The internet has done that for the past 25 years, and it's not as if we've seen more bio attacks increase. So I'm unsure about the whether or not the age of large models is going to substantially increase the ability of people to be able to create biological weapons. Because when I speak to structural biologists and others in sort of in the field, they basically tell me that the choke points are not really knowledge. You can find out a lot of that stuff from the internet if you'd like. The things are having the expertise, I suppose, to like know on how to put all that stuff together. But crucially, it's actually like restrictions on materials and to a lesser extent equipment and to a lesser extent after that lab space. And they're the sort of the choke points that have prevented the world from sort of experiencing severe bioweapon attacks in the last the last 25 years or whatever.
And I also feel that when we think of models that are so smart that they can generate bioweapons, we also have to consider the benefits here. Like, these things are going to be amazing. They'll be able to cure so many diseases. And so, like, if the net benefit, like the expected value of benefits greater than the expected value of costs, we shouldn't be as concerned about it, because, like, yes, they might be able to create a bioweapon, but they might as well be able to create the cure or the vaccine to that. So, like, I always feel like that this discussion is premature. We should be worried about current day harms, because one day when we get to it, we'll see it. But until then, it's as good as discussing it. It's like throwing darts with a blindfold on. Maybe they could buy weapons, maybe not, who knows?
Well, exactly. That is exactly that. I couldn't have said it better myself, which is why evals are the way to go, because you answer that question, or at least you try and answer that question. But let me come back to the start of that. So you think that there's like a pretty obvious capabilities ceiling on the current paradigm, and you don't think it's going to be able to do lots of the different things that people are worried about, like act autonomously or replicate autonomously as well.
Yeah, I mean, act autonomously maybe, but like so far, our alignment of these autonomous agents has been okay. I mean, they've not been good enough, and so, and I don't expect them to deviate so much from the current text-based generation thing, where they follow my instructions quite well. So I don't see why that's a serious problem, and I don't think that they'll be able to replicate autonomously, just because like it takes so much compute to do that, and humans can't compute. Where the AI is going to get it from? I mean, to use hyperbole.
Yeah, sure. I'm sympathetic to that a little bit, but my concern is that when you look back over the last 2 years, the scale of capability increases within the current paradigm have been absolutely phenomenal compared to what many people, including myself, thought we were going to be in for. It didn't really look like we were going to get anywhere near as far as we did with scaling, and seemed to be likely to get in the future as well. So, looking back at just the very recent history, last couple of years, makes me very skeptical about being, too sure one way or another about where this paradigm will lead in the next couple of years.
Yeah, no, that's fair, I guess. But like a lot of these, I mean, like the compute constraint is a hardware constraint, right? I mean, even if they get really smart, in the end they're gonna need more GPUs to run on, or like maybe they'll be able to run on CPUs, but like that, even then you still need more physical infrastructure to run by.
Right, well, you're talking about Foom in that context. And yeah, I agree with you. I actually think, people talk about a lot of the inherent weaknesses of the large model paradigm, the sort of giant model approach. Talk about, the fact that explainability is very difficult, mechanistic interpretability is proving tricky, although seems to be more tractable than we thought in the last couple of months. Sure, but also I would say that like one of the big benefits from a safety point of view is actually how compute orientated these things are. I think we're not in a position, at least as far as I can see, where you're going to have these systems that are going to be able to recursively self-improve as well as what was once thought, because it's difficult to get access to the raw resources you need to do that, which is compute. It's very, very clear when you're running another training run to be able to improve significantly as far as these sort of iterations are concerned. So in that sense, I agree with you, and I think I'm glad that the paradigm exists in the way it does, because I suspect compute will be an important choke point, right, when we think about safety. In the same way that some of those sort of factors in terms of lab space and raw materials and knowledge are for bio risk, right? I think there's probably some interesting parallels there.
Okay, so we're almost at the end of our time here. So let's say tomorrow morning the president of the US called you, okay, and said, "Hattie, I'm going to pass any law you want into Congress is going to pass everything you need. The best of the American government will be here to implement whatever you say." What specific policy recommendations would you give him?
Yeah, tough one because of course I'm English, so I'd be concerned that the President of the United States isn't being advised by his team in America. But I don't know. I think really I would probably be hesitant to call for a muscular national regulator or even a muscular international regulator at the moment. I think that there are probably different sort of options that you could take with respect to like either of those different things. But I think for me, the focus ought to be on the most dangerous risks and mitigating those. And I think there are probably a couple of ways to do that. I think you want to have, there's probably more to be done within existing international frameworks, first of all. Working under the aegis of bodies like the UN and elsewhere, and even if you're talking about, from an international perspective, of course, creating an arm's length IAEA style body, there's lots that could be done within the existing sort of superstructures of international governance. I think perhaps at the moment the IPCC plus plus approach is probably the way to go. I think the vanilla IPCC approach, and that's about just to declare the efforts to monitor climate change, probably aren't quite right for AI alone, just because essentially you're talking about monitoring capabilities and then providing advice to folks to be able to then build policy with. I think you could probably build a little bit on top of that already from a sort of from that vanilla base, and perhaps have a degree of monitoring and kind of compliance built in from the outset. And what I mean by that is that organization could act as a sort of embryonic body that could perhaps either do evaluations themselves, or they could advise on the way in which evaluations ought to be implemented. And one option there could be setting standards. So you could have an international regulator that certifies national regulators to go and to go and allow different countries to provide, I suppose, domestic capability for checking models for dangerous capabilities. I think that would be a really good first step, and it's sort of closer to the civilian model.
I'm surprised your answer is not we ought to have the Manhattan Project for mechanistic interpretability, because it seems as if some of the more recent results by Chris Ola and like other people have shown that we've just touched the edge of it, and the more work we put, we'll probably hit some we'll probably hit some end in we'll probably hit some nice end in it. So like, what do you think of that idea in general?
Yeah, well, first of all, I'd say I'm skeptical of anyone talking about the Manhattan Project for X. I think that is a metaphor that's probably been done to death. But I suppose if we're talking about chucking a load of resources at mechanistic interpretability and see what happens. Yeah, well, the issue with this is that like I struggle to see how the incentives aren't already there for people to solve mechanistic interpretability, right? Like sometimes you hear about different prizes that governments could issue for solving, things like hallucinations, things like mechanistic interpretability. And like that's just not a question of trying to create incentives, because the incentives already exist,
No, but then
just
the like we know from economics literature in general that the social returns to research are so high compared to the private returns to research. And when you compare, would an AI company rather spend money on capabilities or interpretability? And at the margin, and they're rather spending on capabilities. It seems like there's this large positive externality we aren't capturing yet.
I don't know. It's not all that clear to me that there is a significant divide between capabilities and safety research, right?
No, I mean, as in interpretability specifically, in terms of like, where does the mar like which has the largest gap between marginal private and marginal social return?
Sure, but like, The recent example is an interesting one. I mean, where did the recent mechanistic interpretability research come from? It came from a corporate lab.
Yeah, but that's because we haven't yet done the government funding this thing. I mean, at the scale of it. I'm not saying they won't do it. I'm just saying they won't do it at the socially optimal rate. And calculating that is as good as throwing a dart. But at this current moment, it's not socially optimal.
Yeah, and I think more research is always good, right? It doesn't really seem to me to be as a question of a sort of zero sum approach whereby working on one thing detracts from another. So no, I'd be absolutely pro that. Do I think that would be the one policy ask I would make of the world leaders? I don't know. I mean, what I will say is I like the approach that the UK is taking. I like a lot of things about it, but I especially like the emergence of the Frontier Model Task Force. I think they've got some really interesting partnerships, working with some very knowledgeable groups. They'll be working with the sort of major AI labs as well, and that to me feels like they have the seed or something really great there. And I wouldn't be surprised if that kind of fundamental research starts to happen there in the future. But the thing is, like, the UK has done that with less than 500 million quid, right? Like that is not something which takes a huge amount of cash, especially when you consider that Anthropic just raised $4 billion from investment by Amazon. So yeah, I don't know. There's lots of small things that can be done, but I actually think that the ecosystem is in pretty good shape at the moment to be able to do that sort of research, both from a corporate perspective primarily, but given the Frontier Model Task Force in the UK, it wouldn't surprise me if you sort of start to see different domestic approaches modeled on that. Maybe in the US that'll be led by NIST, maybe it'd be led by someone else, but I'm feeling pretty hopeful about that.
All right. Yeah. No, it was very, very fun talking to you. We're sadly at the end of our time. So, thanks so much.
Cool, thank you very much.